Welcome back to the National Rural Education Association podcast. We've been on a little hiatus. As we record this today, Jeff Bezos sent himself and three others into space today for an 11-minute journey, so it's pretty exciting to watch that today and bring a little national pride, even though from the private sector. I fully support Bezos because I order on Amazon Smile a lot, my Smile donation site, so that's a...
As do I.
As do we all, and that's not a bragging point. It's just saying that that is what it is.
Right.
It is exciting to be here with Dr. Chris Silver, our producer, and resident cleanup stuff. Our rural brother from Dunlap, Tennessee.
Brother from another mother.
Yeah, and then Dr. Jared Bigham, our rural brother from the great city of
Turtletown,
Tennessee. It is a pleasure to introduce our guest today, Ben Winchester, University of Minnesota. So he's way up north from us, which is even better. So we'll compare accents a little bit later. His work has been really a refreshing a breath of air to rural communities and rural schools across the country. He is going to be one of our keynote speakers at the National Forum to Advance Rural Education in Indianapolis, November 11th and 12th, shameless plug, and we'll be in an in-depth conversation. But I'll start off with this, and this is what we have to do every time, is Win Learning is a sponsor of our podcast, and we've been on hiatus, and Win Learning's been doing a lot of good work, and they're advancing and doing some great work around soft skills and education and work soft skills credentialing. So we're proud that they're a sponsor, and they're a sponsor for next year as well. So we're excited to have Win Learning a part of us. So Ben Winchester, please introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your work, and then we'll get into questioning.
Right, certainly. It's my pleasure to be here, and thanks for the opportunity to share, you know, what I've gleaned over my past 25 years. Really, my name is Ben Winchester. I'm a rural sociologist with the University of Minnesota Extension. I think you know Extension as the 4-H people. I'm actually not in 4-H. I'm in a different sliver that we call a community vitality, and we've really focused ourselves over the past 15 years on increasing the vibrancy of rural Minnesota through applied research and education. So my pleasure to be here.
Hey, thanks for taking time and carving out time. I'm going to do shameless plug questions. So you are keynoting, you're part of a TED Talk, you're also doing a breakout presentation. So what are folks that are attending either virtually or in person going to gain from your presentation and your walk through rural economic development and kind of community development?
Right. It's been certainly my pleasure to be able to kind of share all this good news about small towns. The premise behind the majority of the research I've done in my life has been that the narrative we're using to describe our small towns is terrible. And it's based out of the 50s and may not actually reflect anything that's happened in the past 25 years. So literally from the year I've been born, 1970, until today, the trends that I see in terms of an increasing rural population in many parts of the country, an increasing vibrancy in the presence of nonprofit groups that keep growing and growing, as well as a more diverse economy that we've got across rural America. Like, these are all trends that paint an upward path. And I think the narrative, you know, commonly told is that rural America is dying. And that, you know, the best and brightest are lucky to escape. But the story that we tell is one of returnees, is the one of transplants. It's one of people choosing to move to small towns and rural places. And why do they move? For what reasons do they have? What's the composition of their family? You know, are they moving just for a job or not? Those are the kinds of things that we ask questions about. Do these people feel welcomed? You know, how are they involved civically, socially? Are they active or not? So I think in many ways, we just want people to have a better narrative about our rural communities, because if your narrative is terrible, who would ever want to move in there, right? But I think my broader point here is, if rural America is dying, then why can't I find a house to buy? Like, doesn't that inequitable statement right there just kind of clarify and solidify the fact that rural America is not dying and has not been dying for a long time? So I would argue that rural America does not need to be saved. We've saved ourselves. And in what ways? We will find that out.
So that's good.
That's my plug there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Good. Yeah.
Hey, I'm attending the session.
Great.
You know, it's interesting that you pointed out that the narrative and perception of rural communities hasn't changed much since the 50s. And I was reading an article yesterday somebody sent me about how TV and the TV shows in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s that had a rural theme, that really painted the picture for most of America about what rural was like. So you had the Andy Griffith Show, Petticoat Junction, Beverly Hillbillies. You have there was just a ton of different rural themed shows that created this perception out there across the country. So I don't know if you've ever looked at that or read anything about that, but I think it's interesting you bring that up. And I read that article yesterday.
No, I think that's spot on. In terms of kind of that, there's that nostalgic feel, I think, that people have around what they think a small town is. And, you know, there was that Chevy Chase movie, right, where he was trying to dress up his house and paying all the locals in this terrible town he lived in, right? Well, it's really not like that. I mean, I think people do have this pastoral view of small towns, or this kind of Norman Rockwellish approach to what they think they're going to find or expect to find in many ways. Yeah. And when it doesn't match that up, they tend to think it's, you know, not a small town, or it's not. There, it's dying. But, you know, I think one of the biggest shifts we've become accustomed to is a boarded up building. I think, you know, we do have remnants of the past in our small towns, boarded up schools or banks or whatnot, from an economy gone by, really. And it's not to say we're going to go back to an economy we previously had. We live in a globalized world. It's what's reasonable today, what's feasible today to operate as a business in a small town. What's feasible, especially as we move the majority of our jobs into regional centers. So we have people commuting in and out every day. And this is part of the story of living, of what I call living in the middle of everywhere. And we're going to have a breakout on this at the conference. And that really, it gets to the point that, you know, we don't just live and work and shop and play in a single town. We live in a region, and this region can actually be quite large, you know, as far as how far do you go out to shop or eat out in the past year. So really, when we think about all of the different ways that we have negative narrative, like, I try to counter that, like, you know, everybody knows one another. You don't. Nobody locks their doors. You do. Like, you know, I live in the middle of nowhere. I'm like, really? Is that how you're trying to portray yourself? It's like, there's nothing there. Like, oh, you know, I mean, to some people, that totally is attractive, the idea of nothingness. But in terms of, like, you actually are surrounded by assets all over in the region.
And you know what's interesting too is I just want to give a shout out to Jared and Alan for a second, because one of the things that they've consistently brought up on our podcast in the past, sorry, this is Dr. Silver, and one of the things they brought up on our podcast in the past that I think is a really profound point is how much do we see people when they go off to, say, higher education, how many of them return to their rural communities? And, you know, I'm just like my colleagues. I'm one of those people who left a small town, went to college. And, you know, there's a lot of things there, I think, that are important. One is the economic opportunity, but also there's the cultural challenges, which is, in fact, Alan and I've spent, years discussing this, is that, you know, coming from a small town myself, I don't fit in anywhere anymore. I don't quite fit in academia because I'm from a small town. I don't quite fit in a small town because I'm academic. You know, and how do we create these spaces in rural America where people can, you know, leave and then feel compelled to come back and give back?
Yeah. No, that's great. I think they have. One of the biggest findings we've had is newcomers are fairly isolated, and you don't actually recognize all of the other new people in town that may have a doctorate or may have a master's, because there are so few opportunities for social engagement today. So what we have found, we found in our research that just 25% of rural movers are from that town, i.e. a returnee. So really 3/4 of new people moving into our small towns are not from there. So there's, you know, in terms of, like, not fitting in, there have been people that, quote unquote, not fit into our small towns for decades. It's just they felt more isolated, where with technology today, you can feel much more connected to people, where in previous, you know, you were very isolated, very alone for whatever kind of interests or topics or sexual orientation or whatever it is that you had in the past, where now you can feel more connected. And I would argue that in many ways, our small towns have changed. It's just not very visible, especially in terms of community leadership. We struggle to ensure that the leadership represents the characteristics of the community that they're leading. We also have opportunities for newcomers to be engaged. And then what do those actually look like? On whose terms are we leading? So in many ways, we hear comments, again, kind of negative narrative about people moving in and, like, well, you just need to learn how we do it around here. well, what are you really saying when you make a comment like that, right? You're not really recognizing and realizing the potential that that person has. You're trying to get them to fit into a mold that may not actually exist in your town. And so there are a lot of questions that I get around, like, how do these newcomers learn about our culture? And while, you know what, I think this is a very complex issue, and we're not going to, you know, answer this question today, but I like to think of America as not as a melting pot, but as a stew. And I'm not hoping that everybody melts away their culture. I want these cultural reflections in our small towns. We currently see these reflections in the nonprofit groups that we've got. They're varied and more diverse than ever before. And yeah, you're right. People are not in the Eagles Club, but they're in the bicycling group, and they're in the canoeing groups or the shooting groups or whatever it is. So life looks different. But we still do have a challenge in trying to connect the traditional older populations in our rural communities with the newer groups, and have a respect and recognition from both sides. It is definitely work for us to do.
Yeah, and I think I see the challenge as a resident of a very rural community in engaging with people, because unless you have a church you attend, so that's one day a week or a couple of days a week and some activities, right, that in rural communities, that's one area of engagement. And then the other one is if you have children in school, that you might engage with people at ball games or other activities that the school sponsors. But other than that, it's pretty limited in engagement opportunities. I mean, if there's a local diner or something like that, you might see people and engage with people. But, you know, we'd typically have a couple of holiday type festivals a year. And so there's limited opportunity, I think, in rural communities for those, especially different demographics, to engage.
Right. No, I think there's a tension we feel between the old, I would say the old place-based groups and the newer interest-based groups. They tend not to overlap with one another a lot. And the place-based groups are really focused on a smaller, you know, unit of geography, we call it, where the, you know, these, you know, regional groups, the arts, the recreation groups, these tend to be county-wide, like multiple counties encompass the membership of these groups. So essentially our place-based groups have declined in membership and struggle to find opportunities for people to get engaged, because there is real work to be done in our small towns. And at the same time, we've got people that want to be affected and interested in things that they're good at, or things that they have an interest in, you know, the canoeing, the, you know, trap shooting, whatever it is. So we build things that we call bridging events, and that is trying to bridge these two groups, because on one hand, that regional group, it may not actually exist in your town. The nonprofit actually exists like two counties to the north. So you might not even know that these newcomers are already engaged in these nonprofit groups unless we ask them. But you don't know everybody in our small town. So how do you even know where these people truly are? You may have run across them at the gas station or the grocery store or something, but ultimately we don't know everybody. But once you do get to know these newcomers and find out how far they travel for work, how far they travel to eat out or shop, and more importantly for us, recreate, where do they get out and about and actively engage themselves in civic life? That just, it looks different than it did in the past. So there is more work to be done, but it's not easy work. And a lot of groups don't want to pay for community development work. You know, they want to pay for outcomes. Yeah. So I think this is a real opportunity for our small towns to kind of build that social infrastructure as we move forward.
And that community development work is not something you get done in 3 years or 5 years, you know, a typical grant cycle that a lot of people operate under. I when I go into communities and I do collective impact work or help consult on collective impact work, I tell people, if you really are trying to make a change, then you've got to think long term. This is a 18 to 20 year process,
right,
as far as doing something, outcomes with your education system, outcomes within your community, growing your community, your workforce. And so that discourages people sometimes, but really that's what it takes. So a question I had is, when you do research, do you ever go back to these communities and share that with like a county commission and county mayor and folks like that, to see if they are interested in attacking some of the challenges you might find and opportunities that you might find in your research?
Yes, we've been very lucky here in Minnesota. We've been conducting this research for almost 17 years now. And one of the early groups in Western Minnesota has developed a program called Get Rural. And it's one of about a dozen what we call resident recruitment initiatives across the state that have sprouted up as a result of this applied research. So yeah, when you start retelling the story about these positive things, people are like, oh yeah, there's new people moving in. Let's help them out for the first couple months. Let's, bring them a pizza the first day when they're exhausted and tired, pizza and beer, right? So what are just these small things we can do to help encourage a welcoming culture in the community? So really, we do see a lot of different ideas out there. There's no, I will say, well-worn path of how to do resident recruitment. We've got some organizations that do collective regional marketing, like how do you market this region to people in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul area? Or we do other things like lift up the voices of tourists, because what we have found in our research is that many of the reasons that people say that they move to our small towns are the reasons that people visit them as a tourist. And we've shown that there are great opportunities to transition tourists into full-time residents. If you've got to invite them, you've got to let them know your town is not dying. You've got economic and social opportunity, but it is like turning the narrative on its head and flipping the script about what this community is. And when you start to lift up the voices of the new residents, you hear a narrative about the community that you may have never been heard before. And this is especially important for me for the school children, because a lot of times our school kids think if they're living in a negative narrative household, they think there's nothing there for them and they will not return to that small town in 20 years. Like just on the front side, we have to be okay with some of our kids leaving. And what are you going to tell your kids to stay? Build more resentment in your 18-year-old, tell them they can't leave town after they graduate, right? But really, they're going to leave, but do they think they can ever return? I think that type of optimism is a data point you can look at, and you can ask your seniors, do you think this is a town you can come back to? When in reality, when we start to put together here in Minnesota, some of the newcomer perspectives with high school students, they see hope and opportunity, because our main message here is nobody moves to small towns for pity. And if you've got a negative narrative, I'm not like, hey, I'm going to move to Hancock. I'm going to help you out because you lost your hardware store 28 years ago, right? Nobody moves for pity. So when we start to lift up these voices of newcomers, we hear stories of hope, of opportunity, and a more than viable future for not just the household, but the community.
Hey, and I'm going to add, I think you brought up a good point. You kind of led into my question. There's two parts here. Number one, the communities you're seeing that are kind of making this swing and doing better things and promoting a positive narrative, do they have a festival or some kind of block party or something in town that kind of draws people to them to kind of do the bridge activity you talked about? And then number two, how important or are there students involved in the innovation decision-making or the process? So it's kind of two-part question.
Yeah, right. No, the bridging events for us are crucial. They're the ones that really allow some of our groups to feel reinvigorated when they, breathe new life into shared projects. I think part of our point on the bridging is that our organizations right now are like, hey, we need board members and we've got six things we do every year. How do we get those six things done? Where really, we're not leaving any room for new people to define what that organization means for them. So really, can we find opportunities? You still have your mission of your organization, but we've got multiple ways to get there. And are you allowing room for newcomers to define what that mission means for them? And then to, build energy and capitalize those types of ideas. So those types of bridging events ultimately for us improve the narrative on both sides. It allows the newcomers to see these existing groups that many times have great talents and resources that are totally unseen by the newcomer generation as they move in. But at the same time, there's these newcomers that we see coming in, they're spending more dollars, they're leading more groups, they're active civically, but it looks different. So because it looks different, we tend not to see them within our traditional techniques. So bridging events really allow that kind of cross narrative to exist. And sorry, your question about the students, involving students in leadership. I mean, this has always been part and parcel of the, you know, as a community developer, you know, we're always trying to ensure that we've got voices of young people moving forward. A lot of times one of the best strategies we've had in terms of improving the narrative is we call it the best $150 ever spent. And it's a newcomer supper. And it's a supper not for, you know, the existing residents to come and gawk at all the new people. It's a supper just for the newcomers. And the newcomers, the number one outcome out of that is the newcomers saying, I can't believe how many other new people there are here. But at the same time, one of the things we like to encourage is to have high school students then interview those new people for very brief 1 to 2 minute segments. And like, what do you like about this town? And it's those type of opportunities that then allow students to improve their own narrative and maybe countering that narrative that may exist in town in terms of like the community's gone by. Like it's a very interesting dynamic when you get young people involved and not just hear those voices, but then to carry those voices forward through leadership positions that, again, may or may not exist in your small towns. As a community developer, we are always trying to ensure that we've got representation by age, race, ethnicity, gender, right? All of these things. But it doesn't always look that way. So if anything, we just try to reaffirm to people that there are positive trends. Your kids should have a voice, not just in the community now, because they may have a voice in the future. So the leadership of our community is written by people that aren't even here yet. And what does that look like when we're just welcoming and involving people in on the front end?
That's a great point. I think that, and I appreciate you being open and honest about the student voice, because that's a big part of the future. And they're going to be your future school board members or county execs, right, or mayors or whatever it may be. So usually at this time in the process, Dr. Bigham is going to ask you our closing question, but our build upon closing question. And it is, and I'll let him describe the whole aspect, but this is a one that we ask most guests on the podcast. So Dr. Bigham, let him have the loaded question.
We call this the Harry Potter question because we're allowing you to have a magic wand for one wave. And the rules are you only get one wave to do something in the rural space. So if you could do anything with that magic wand, what would your wave be?
Well, easily the number one thing I would do right now is build independent senior living housing, single floor living, patio homes, whatever it was. One third of our rural homes today are owned by people over the age of 75. They are staying in their homes longer than any previous generation has stayed in their homes. And this, for me, actually inhibits the inflow of people into our rural communities, because if literally there is no place for them to live, it's hard to welcome people in. So essentially, we talk about workforce housing shortages, about labor shortages. This is all solved when we start to build senior housing, move folks out of their family homes, and open up the family homes that they're currently residing within.
I like it. I had never thought about that. And actually, we've had a previous guest that's a friend of mine that was looking at rural educator housing and having a cluster of educators in some single level patio type community that he's looking doing that in rural communities to help recruit teachers and retain teachers in rural communities. So maybe we need to get him to extend his scope of work, Pratt, and do these single level homes for elderly folks in rural communities.
I think that's a great idea. And Ben, I think that opens up the housing market to folks, to the newbies, to come in and fix those homes up that the 70 plus were staying in, and kind of highlight those architecture features of those older homes in those rural communities. So that's an amazing answer.
Yeah, I just see it as the number one avenue for us moving forward. Like, we can talk about the newcomers, we can talk about welcoming people in, but the trickle of people moving in has slowed greatly because, you know, again, if our small towns are dying, why can't I find a house to buy? It's because our seniors are staying in their homes longer than any previous generation. The number of older people will not be going down anytime soon. And I'm not even talking about baby boomers. This is the generation older than the baby boomers that we're building housing for. So we call it housing churn. There's always people moving in, people moving out, and people moving over. And as we look forward, I see about 3/4 of all rural housing turning over in the next 20 years. So we've got a lot of welcoming to work on.
Well, I think the big thing as we close this out is if you want to know more and learn more from Ben, come to the conference. You'll get a, he'll be there in person, and you get a chance to rub elbows and all that good stuff. If you can't attend in person, attend virtually, and you'll have access to him as well. It has been a pleasure, Ben, and I'm really excited about you coming to the conference, really excited about our folks learning from you. And we need to talk about getting you to Tennessee, and we'll definitely follow up about that as well. So thanks for being with us today.
Hey, certainly my pleasure. Thanks for the voice you've got.
Appreciate it.
All right. Well, that wraps us up with another episode. Look forward to engaging with folks at the conference coming up just around the corner and continuing our conversations on the NERA podcast. So thanks for joining.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast and website are those of Dr. Alan Pratt, Dr. Jerry Bingham, and Dr. Christopher F. Silver, and do not represent the affiliated universities and or any organization affiliated with the hosts. This podcast and any accompanying material, including our website, represent the opinions of Dr. Alan Pratt, Dr. Jared Bingham, and Dr. Christopher F. Silver, and their guests to the show and website. The content here should not be taken as medical or professional advice and should be used at your own risk. The content here is for informational purposes only and should be understood as such. The Rural Voice podcast or its hosts do not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, process, service, or organization presented or mentioned in this podcast, and the information from this podcast should not be referenced in any way to imply such approval or endorsement. Further, the content of this podcast are the property of the National Rural Education Association and are protected under U.S. and international copyright and trademark law. No other use, including without limitation, reproduction, retransmission, or editing of this podcast may be made without prior written permission. By listening to this podcast, you agree to the terms and conditions, and while we make every effort to ensure that the information that we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. Thank you.